My name is Louis Thomas, and I'm here with Val Jensen, and we're here to talk about Mary Thomas and what impact she had on her life. Val, could you give me just a little bio about yourself?
Hi, Louis. Yes, my name is Val Jensen, and when I met Mary, I was a student of archaeology. Now I work doing environmental management on a golf course. We also worked with Mary and conducted tours for school-aged children at the Kingfisher Environmental Interpretive Center, which was another one of Mary Thomas's projects.
But you always seem to pop in and out of her life, and could you tell me a little more about it?
Yes. Well, I was so fortunate that when I first met Mary, it was at a presentation that she was doing at the university. And it was in one of my anthropology classes, and I had never met her before, but she was just an incredible woman. She would speak in front of a room of people and just captivate them, and I was one of those people that was absolutely captivated by her. And very fortunate that she liked me too, and we worked together for years and years, and she honored me by adopting me into her family and teaching me her culture.
She was one of those that were a real gifted speaker. Did you ever notice that about her?
She was just amazing. She could take a crowd of people and just make them mesmerized. She could take people from all walks of life and talk to them just as if they were her family. And at the end of it all, they were just completely wrapped around her little finger.
You spent a lot of time with her, say, even out with some of her forays out in the bush. Can you tell me a little about that?
I did. That was one of our favorite times together, or some of our favorite times together. She liked to go for walks in the forest, and there wasn't a plant that she walked over that she didn't know the use of and the name of, and whether it was a food or whether it was a medicine or whether it had a story connected. So we spent a lot of time learning. I spent a lot of time learning. She spent a lot of time teaching in the forests, and we spent a lot of time doing just that.
You know, you talk about some of her friends and, you know, the interaction with other people. How do you feel? Did you ever notice how she did it?
Well, she, like I said, she just captivated people. She had a way with people, and she made us all feel like we were so important. And I think that is such a gift. People just, that's something you're born with. I don't think that you can be taught. And she had a way with people that, even though she spoke of things like, for instance, the residential school, when she spoke about the residential school, she did it in such a gentle way, and she was so soft-spoken that you always felt like you were part of her story. So she had a magic way with people.
She did leave a legacy, and I was wondering what type of legacy did she really leave?
I think what she gave the world was interaction. She made us all feel like we were part of the bigger picture. She never drew lines between cultures or families. She always included. She was very inclusive. So I think she left so many of us with her story, her experiences, and she once told me that she was intent on building bridges between cultures, and all of the people that she taught and all of the people that she adopted into her family were her bridges, and that's what she left. She left those bridges and teachers.
Thank you, Val.
The whole idea behind this going out and getting your spiritual strength.
But that wasn't necessarily true for a girl. She didn't necessarily find her guardian spirit.
Well, it was very seldom they ever come back without a spiritual understanding.
So it really was more of a spiritual understanding rather than a guardian spirit per se.
Yeah, a spiritual understanding and, of course, self-discipline. This going out and being on their own is like going through a self-testing period.
Yeah, no, I can certainly see that. Like,
and even that, went right through even after the girl was married. She had to really practice what she learned to prove herself a fit wife and mother to the children.
Would she, while she was going through these different different rites, would she meditate on the things that would be expected of her as a good mother?
Like taking those little needles off of the bow was to train my hands when I'm gathering my food, picking berries. This is how fast my hands have to go. Because my mother used to say, whatever you did within that year, if you liked your sleep and you slept and slept and slept, you were training yourself to be a lazy person. But if you trained yourself just a drop of a little noise, you wake up right now and you're wide awake and you look and see what it is.
You train yourself to be alert.
Yes. That's see, that's part of the training session, that type. It's like maybe, say, you're teaching a child all year. At the end of the year, you're going to put that child through the final test. What did you learn this year? Well, the child has been learning since the time they were this high.
Yeah.
And now they're going to go into another stage of their life. So instead of the parents putting them to a test, they put themselves through that test. How much did I learn? But that feeling, that inspiration was put into them by the everyday treatment of that child from the parents. The child did something wrong, they were disciplined right away. And they were told why they were being disciplined. And if they did something good, they were rewarded by, not by material things, but by love. Eh? And I think any child just thrives on love. You know, if you just throw a penny at a kid and say, oh, here, you're a good boy. It isn't anything like giving a nice pat on the head and holding them and telling them, you know, you are excellent, you're a very good child. And they thrive on this. And that's what our Indian parents a long time ago did.
Sorry, if I could just interrupt for a second here. I wanted to get arrowhead. Would you even have any idea how to spell that? Or should we wait and try and use your dictionary?
I wished, if I had known, I would have brought my dictionary with me.
How did you pronounce it?
Stachka. Stachka.
Stachka.
Stachka.
What would, I'm trying to, a green river, what would that be? What word would you use?
Green is called. And if you have to put water on the end, the color,
right?
Kulaltqua, kulaltqua, kulaltqua.
Okay, that's for water.
Yeah.
And what was the word for green again?
Kualt, kualt, kulaltqua, kulaltqua.
I tried to learn Thompson. I didn't have much luck. Kualt. I'll have to get the correct spelling, but at least I'll have an idea. And what about for a river that was dirty, that was muddy? What would you call it? Muddy.
Tuk-tuk. 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 That's really tongue-twisting.
Two syllables?
Tuk-tuk. Tuk-tuk.
So it's two kind of T sounds?
Tuk-tuk.
Tuk-tuk. Okay.
Yeah,
okay, it's that TKW sound. So. And the second syllable, I'm sorry, again?
It's almost just two of them, just tick, 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 tick,
tick. Almost more of a tick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the word that I'm looking for, like, I think Kamloops was supposed to mean where rivers meet, isn't that right? What word would you use in Shuswap for you to describe a place where two rivers came together?
The word Kamloops itself is not in the Shuswap dialect.
Oh, is that right?
Even the word itself, Shuswap, that has no meaning in the language.
What's the people's word for themselves?
The people's word, you mean for each? They were identified by where about you live.
I see. So
like
a
people, yeah, people that lived around Chase were identified. They called them Skaltkemch, means you're up the river.
I see.
And if you live down at Kamloops, you're Sutemtkemch, that means you're lower down the river.
I see.
And I'm trying to think. Sycamus is named because of all the waters meeting.
Oh, yes.
It's in between.
Mm-hmm.
And they call it, the Indian name is Sycamus.
Sycamus.
So they say Sycamus.
I see.
Sycamus, that's the real word
okay.
for in between where the waters meet. Sycamus.
Would that apply to where rivers meet too?
Yeah, all waters, a river or lakes or whatever, just the water.
Okay.
Sycamus.
I can come up with something. I can't use that one. Okay, I want to use a fictitious one. I was trying to think of some other.
Let me think if I can think of
the
another.
The Thompson name is
Kamshin.
That same.
To go around that Chienmausen. Chienmausen is going around a mountain, the
oh,
river.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Let me see if I can piece it together.
Okay.
Chienmausen. Oh, Hupetkwa. Hupetkwa is another, a river coming into another. That's what you're looking for.
Okay.
Right,
okay.
Now
okay.
We got it.
Okay, that's
Hupetkwa.
Exactly.
Hupetkwa.
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 That has an X at the end of it.
Yeah. I have to kind of draw a picture.
Okay, that's, no, sure, that's great.
I have to walk that's that great. River and the lakes before I can find the word. Hupetkwa.
Okay, now I'll check some of these up on spelling eventually, but at least I'll have the words
mm-hmm.
to work with. So, okay, what I'm trying to do then is to this girl is going to go back and she's going to try to get the kind of training that she needs to go out. It'll be abbreviated for a whole variety of reasons, but I would like her to find exactly what you're talking about, the kind of the self-discipline and the spiritual understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how the spiritual understanding would be made known to the girl? How would she become aware of her spirituality in relationship to the land and to the environment and so forth?
The way I understand it and the way the old people explained it is when you, through meditation and through your real belief into Mother Earth and its creation, if you set your mind on something, you really meditate on it, and you believe that thing is going to actually happen in your life. When they say that when you're asleep, your subconscious mind is doing the work for you, your mind's still awake, and this is what the old people used to believe. That's why they used to say when an elder is sleeping, children were told to be very quiet, not to startle the old people when they're sleeping, because their subconscious mind is still
sort of dreaming
in another kind
time.
Of a
reality.
World.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's in that stage that something will come that is unusual. And then they begin to see a vision from that.
Even during their waking hours as well.
The vision, they claim, sort of transforms them even after they wake up. It stays with them. And they have that strong feeling that this is the spirituality that they're looking for. It's through that meditation, like during their sleep.
I see.
They always had that saying that it'll come to you in a dream. Even in little myths. I don't know if you've seen that little myth, that little The Boy in the Loom. It was in that kit. Well, you notice there that the grandmother told the boy that the smile, that he was wondering why his grandmother never smiled, because she was sad. And the only thing that she was living for was to see her grandson grow up to be a man. And when he grew up to be a man meant that when he first started getting the fish and the meat and he became, yes, and that's when
she smiled.
Yeah, and she told him that it'll come to you in your dream. So that's sort of like indicating as to how they really believed in the spirituality. Kids used to really enjoy that.
But I think the kids oftentimes forget the significance behind the stories and that they were used as teaching tools.
Well, even there, I remember as a child, my mother, my grandmother, any of the elders, before we went to sleep, they always told us these little Indian fairy tales.
Mm-hmm.
And after they finished telling you the story, they always gave you a little lesson with it. The reason why this happened, the boy, the mother, the grandmother and the boy there, they were accepted into the tribe while they had the father and the mother, then the father was the supporter, and when they disappeared, well, the other parts of the tribe felt they were a burden and they were just given the bones of a deer, and you know, the things they didn't really care to have was given to the grandmother, and she was very sad. And then when her grandson became a man and they got all the meat, the fish and everything they needed for winter and were able to have so much that they could afford to give some to the needy, and that was the same people that came to them when they were in need, and she taught them a lesson, and she wouldn't give in to them till the fourth time they begged for the little children, if only for the little children. And she told her son to bring down the bundles, the best bundles of the best of their foods, and give it to them. She was teaching that chief a lesson that when you see somebody down, you don't step on them. You help them instead. And she was teaching them a lesson that, you know, you're always willing to give and receive. And they always had little lessons in the myths they told the children. That was part of your education.
Mm-hmm.
That you were never greedy. That you were never selfish. And if you were selfish, you were too proud, you're the one that suffered for it in the end. And all the little Indian fairy tales that I used to tell in schools all had little lessons to them.
Did the women sing songs as well? Did they have chants that they sang?
Oh, yeah.
Again,
that was passed on. That song came to you in that meditation.
That's
through your
what I
puberty.
Understand, yeah.
Yeah, it came to you. And it is your privilege to pass. Nobody could sing your song at a gathering. And if you wanted to give that song, you trained. Say, supposing I had a song and I wanted to leave it in memory of me, I would have to choose a person that would respect it and it would have a meaning to it.
Mm-hmm. Would the song be a tune, or would it be words, or would it be both?
It would be both, because there's that meditation in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the words would be in your... When you sang it and you danced with it, it was the story being told with your hands,
mm-hmm.
of the early morning, thanking the Great Spirit for the day he's given you. And then you explained by motions of the hand what you see, the trees, the wind blowing and shaking the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And you watched down on the waters, the ripples on the water, the wind playing on top of the waters. And your dance is all this, but you just didn't make it up. It was a thing that you seen while you were away from the rest of the elders.
Mm.
I watched it. I was as a little girl. They used to have gatherings in the old log houses.
And they used to still do that?
They still did it, yeah.
See, we're not that far away, really, are we?
No.
It seems like it's a
million years ago. I've seen it as a child, and I guess if I had remained at home, I could still do it.
Mm-hmm.
But just at that age where I was really beginning to get aware of things is when I was just taken away and put in the residential school.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that gap in my life that I lost of my Indian, the knowledge of my Indianness. And that was the gap I had to go all the way back and gather as information,
mm-hmm.
and really concentrate on it and really see when I had that job with Ursula Surtees. that is when I really began to look at it as something that was, that I should have been really proud of all the time, eh? Mm-hmm. And yet here I was at that crazy mixed-up stage. I was ashamed of being an Indian. And I used to ask the Creator, why did you make Indians? You know, we're supposed to be no good. Our religious beliefs were supposed to be the work of the devil. They were evil. And I used to really believe it.
You really did believe it?
Oh, I definitely did. I just condemned being an Indian. I used to hate myself for being an Indian. The only thing that I used to be thankful was at least I'm not as dark as some of them. Right. I used to think, eh? I put on a bathing suit, my body is just about as white as yours. And, you know, that was a mistake of my mother's, and I was condemned for it when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. And I guess because I was condemned for it and hating my Indianness, that I could have ended up on Skid Row. But it was that determination, that stubborn streak I had in me that I thought, all right, you condemn me now, but there must be something in this education, in this new kind of lifestyle, there must be something. And I guess I was constantly searching. And when I found out what it was that I was looking for here, I was right back to where I started, as an Indian. Mm. And it gave me back the strength that I had missed in that one long period of my life, mm-hmm. that Indian feeling that, you know, that, gee whiz, it's not that bad to be an Indian. It's what you make of it that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it all builds right back to the teaching that our ancestors gave to the children. I lost it somewhere along the line. But going back and studying it and looking at the nice side of it, that's what gave me the strength to really be myself. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, just as a human being. Mm-hmm. And I guess a scar will always be there. I'm always kind of a little bit, that not too trusting will always be with me for as long as I live, I guess. When I first meet a person, I still have to kind of look at them from all angles. Mm-hmm. And I guess about now I'm a pretty good judge of character. I can tell right away if I'm going to trust a person. And if I can't, then there's just no way will I change my mind. But that was stemmed from the back of the time I started working with Ursula and really studying up on our Indian
identity. And really finding the values in it. I think that's the thing that somehow escapes students, that they still associate being Indian with what they consider to be primitive way of life without mm-hmm. realizing that the spiritual and non-material aspects were anything but primitive, but they were... I mean, I see, you know, young people coming through here who are so totally lacking in that kind of self-discipline.
Yeah.
And that they, you know, the kind of this sort of process that you're describing today was obviously very carefully worked out over a long period of time and couldn't help but result in a young woman or a young man who had a tremendous sense of themselves, of their spirituality, and of their obligations to their community and to their family. And we've lost that. We've got no rites of passage anymore. There's no passage from youth to adulthood. This showed the people of your tribe that you're ready to become an adult, to become a complete...
That's true.
We don't have that anymore. Where do we do? How does a white person make that transition anymore, or an Indian anymore, for that matter?
That's especially when the young are going away.
They leave home. They have no obligations to their family or the community.
Cut ties off.
Sure. I mean, but the nearest thing they have to it is when they get their driver's license, and they can roar up and down the street. Mm-hmm. I mean,
and you take the difference today. I find parents tend to think, just as soon as my child graduates, wow, they're on their own now, eh? And they don't realize that's really the scariest part of their life, to be on their own, away from that supervision. But the difference with our people, when a girl has come back from that search of spirituality and a test in her ability to be a woman, when she comes back, she's automatically given in marriage to the family son that's been chosen for her.
Mm.
And she takes that role, and she has to prove to that new family that she belongs to, mm-hmm. that she is a worthwhile young woman, eh? And that's her constant thought, is that she is the number one. And she, if she proves herself that, then she's fully accepted by that family.
Family she's married into.
And I ask the question, well, supposing she was a very young woman and might have one or two children, and all of a sudden something happened that her husband died all of a sudden, maybe he was killed or was an accident or something. What happens to her and her children? And the understanding that I got from the elders, as she proved herself a fit person, a fit mother, and a fit wife, that she was never left on her own. She was still a part of that family because of her children.
I see.
And she was still accepted by the family. And if there was a brother, which in Indian they call a skelp, there might be a brother or a cousin or some relative of the age that hadn't had a wife spoken for yet. She would be automatically given to this scalp, they call. Or if there wasn't a young man available as a husband, she was given. She had to go back again that 1 year. Same thing, bathing and cleansing.
Oh, I see.
As a widow.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And when she came back after that 1 year again, then she was fully accepted back in. And she was either given as a wife to another part of the family, or if there was no other available young man, she was given as a second wife and kept in the family because the children belonged to that family. Now, supposing that girl did not live up to the expectations of her in-laws, if anything happened to her husband, the children were taken because they belonged to the father's side of the family, were kept. And that girl, after the burial ceremony, that girl would have been taken, her braid, one side, would have been taken and chopped off, was cut off. To cut your hair was a disgrace.
Mm.
And they would cut one side of her hair, and they called suhtmana. They cut that, and then they'd find the oldest pair of moccasins, tie it together, and they'd put it around her neck and turn her around.
And
go back to your people, we don't want you anymore. And that had to be the most disgraceful thing for any young woman. So you had to be prepared from the time you were little up to that puberty stage, and even after that more so, you had to keep right up all the time. To be able to stand up proud and
not be turned away.
Mm-hmm. That was your security. That was your whole lifestyle had to be sort of taught you right from the time you were little. You get to a certain age, you carried on that teaching by self-discipline and self-pride. The boys done the same. And they notched all the brave things they did.
Mm-hmm.
Every time they come out with a brave act, especially getting names were given, sort of hereditary names were given.
After your puberty run?
No, at the birth they gave them hereditary names, but you earned your next name, especially the boys. Well, girls were the same.
Would you find your name while you were on your quest, or not?
No, it had to come as, like the boy. I'll give you an example. This guy, he is the ancestor of the Kinbasket family in Enderby.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived way up towards the Radium Hot Springs, mm-hmm. way out mm-hmm. in that, where they have those mm-hmm. great big high mountains. Well, this guy, they called him Chepchepout. That means trail of blood.
Mm-hmm.
This man, he had his first name. I can't remember. That was a kind of a complicating name. He had gone up the plateaus to hunt. He met up with a grizzly bear. And he tried to kill the bear, he wounded it, and it attacked him. And they always had a big long piece of bone with a notch in here, and it had a leather tied to it, mm-hmm. and that was tied around their wrist. Very, very sharp on both ends. If you shoot a deer or a bear and you couldn't kill it and it attacked you, right away you grabbed for that, and when it opens its mouth,
is that
shove
right?
that oh, in yeah. the mouth, and when they close it, this goes up and this down, and it left their mouth wide open. And you had that knot so you could just pull it and it comes
out. Always carried it with you?
Always when you went hunting. And they claim that's what saved old Chipchipound. And after he find he was mauled something terrible. They say that old man was scarred, something awful. But he finally killed the bear. Now you either gave your life or you killed the animal.
Mm-hmm.
One way or the other. This was Friday. You never came back a failure. You fought till the animal or you dropped. But he did kill that grizzly, but he was badly mauled.
And that's how he got his...
And he started back, and he sang his spiritual strength, came back to him. He started walking, and about halfway down the mountain, he lost so much blood, he started crawling.
Mm.
And he crawled right back down to the river where the rest of the people were camped.
Mm.
And he told them what had happened. He passed out, and of course the old women started bringing in medicine, different kinds of herbs, and attending to all his wounds. The men went up, and all they seen was this trail of blood right up to where the grizzly was. And when that guy got better, they made poultices and everything. And when they got him all better, he was all scarred. They claim he looked hideous because his face was all disfigured. But they had a naming ceremony. And I was told how you give a naming ceremony when you've earned it.
Mm.
They have all the men elders sit around in a circle, and the women sit outside. And they have the leader, it had to be one of the medicine men. They sit that man right part of the circle.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of them elders gives their opinion of what that man, how do I feel, you know, about you, this is how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring him, his feelings up to a standard where he just, you know, he's a real big shot then. And they thank him, and for this, and they chant, chant that this man has been accepted as a brave, and this is your name, given name. And in this case was Chipchipound, and they wet his head with water, and they tell him for the brave deed you made, you are Chipchipound. And then that's the time the women get up and they dance, and every one of them have a gift, whether it's a big piece of buckskin or a basket full of dried meats or berries or some very special embroidered bags or whatever. They dance and they come and they lay it at the feet of Chipchipound.
Would the women have a similar naming ceremony?
Women very seldom, because they never had to go out and do brave things.
So you only got your name after you'd done something brave.
Yeah, and it was mostly the men. The women got their hereditary name.
At birth?
At birth.
And they kept that name
they
pretty much through their life.
They kept that name right through. Because their role in life was pretty well protected.
I see.
They were in a protected environment all the time.
I know, like Calvin, who was interviewed today, he's married to an Indian woman, and they named their children, the grandmother gave them their name.
Mm-hmm.
And the one boy's name was Nikamush, which means thigh bone in Thompson. I think it's thigh. Is that close to Shushma?
What was it?
Nikamush. Yeah, it's Nikamush. It's N-K-W-E-M-U-S.
In Shushwap, this would be our Stuhen.
Oh, something entirely different then.
Yeah.
But it interested me because I don't know what I thought. I was thought names were like prairie names, you know, or plains names, or like, you know, oh, little pine, small pine, things like that. But apparently the Shuswap names tended to be all kinds of different things. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
A lot of it had to do with water. So something about the water. I'll give you another, for instance, of a girl getting a second name. This girl, they called her Sienatqua. And Sienatqua would be something like going around so many waters. Sienatqua.
Oh, okay.
Is going around so many waters. This old couple, they had two daughters, very beautiful girls, and they never had a son. And the father, when he seen his girls growing up, he seen how beautiful they were. And he started thinking way ahead. We have no sons but two daughters. And when they get older, they're sure to be targets for kidnapping by mm-hmm. other tribes. Mm-hmm. So the father really got down to teaching these girls self-discipline, mm-hmm. self-endurance, and, you know, just about anything he could think of for survival. And sure enough, when the girls got to be big girls, they were kidnapped by the what they call the Sicanese.
Oh, yeah, the Sicanese, yeah, up north.
Yeah. They were kidnapped by the Sicanese, and they were taken up the Eagle River.
Yeah.
You know how winding that Eagle River is? Yeah. Apparently these people had been traveling for miles and miles and miles and miles, and they're getting down to where they were so worn out. And on their way up, they have Indian names for all these, like Taft and Mulligan and all those.
Right.
They have Indian names for them, and I can't remember them all. Anyway, my mother used to tell the story about Sienatqua. That was the first time she had been kidnapped. Her and her sister were both kidnapped. And these Sicanese must have had different kind of canoes made out of bark, hemlock bark, is it?
I don't know.
They called tia. Tia. It's made out of a bark canoes.
Mm.
Very light.
Mm.
And when they seen a canoe like that land on the Shuswap Lake, they knew they were Sicanese, and they were very mean, vicious people. Anyway, they really were afraid of the Sicanese, and many, many of our Shuswap women were taken up that
really?
Way. So the Sicanese have a lot of Shuswap blood in them.
Mm.
They were very dreaded people by the Shuswap tribe. Anyway, this Sienatqua and her sister had been captured, and they were quite a ways up the river, I guess. And they found, well, they'd run out of food. So the men left an old guy, one of the eldest, was left to keep an eye on the women and the three canoes that were by the river. And, of course, they had this fire going, and I guess the old man was so tired. And they claim that if your spirituality was so strong, you can cast some kind of a spell on a person. And these men all went hunting, and the old guy was left to look after the camp and the girls. And, of course, the girls, they played up to the old man, and one of the girls got her finger around his hair and so tight that he couldn't get away, and she yanked him down, and the other one killed the old man. Then they took the boats, they loaded all the weapons in one canoe, and they took and slashed all the other ones except one canoe, and they got into it, and they started paddling. And I guess they were about halfway back to the lake at Sicamous when these men got back down, found the old man laying there dead, their canoes were all ripped except one, all their weapons, everything was gone. And they started running down the river. They knew that the girls had gotten away, and they started running. And of course, you know how winding the river is. They have to take every turn.
Yeah.
And but these men, all they had to do was run
straight. Yeah.
And by the time the girls, and they paddled that canoe till their arms, they were just about giving out on them, trying to get down to the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And the story goes that the girls just getting to the lake and they could hear these men coming. And they were making the war whoops coming.
Mm-hmm.
And the older sister says, tells her young sister, if you want, get right down in the bottom of the canoe. If I have to die, I'll die. But I'll paddle you out and they won't be able to catch you up. And the younger sister gets right down flat in the bottom up front and the older sister is just paddling. And I guess it was arrowheads just missing her.
Mm.
They got way out in the middle of the lake and the guys gave up.
Jeez, that's a great story.
And it wasn't long after and they were captured again.
Oh.
And this time it was another, they had an Indian name but I can't remember. It must have been down towards, what you call, towards Spokane.
Oh, yeah.
Just the way they were describing the lakes and this mountain they had to go over. And it, to me, it sounds like they were the people from the Spokane area.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been the Nez Perce.
Yes, although the Nez Perce, I think they came up later, didn't they?
Well, it would have been where the Nez Perce now.
Are now. Right?
Yeah. So that's the area the old people used to talk about. So there again, they were captured and they were blindfolded this time and they were taken there. And I guess the younger one was feeling, you know, really bad. She was crying. And I guess they were really good about looking after everything they were told to do. They would do it. And they got very close. I guess they were really cunning girls. They played up to the wives and the sisters, the women of the tribe. And they would tell them in the end, you know, how lonely, how beautiful the country was up here and how the people and everything. And so the women took it all in and they decided, why don't we help them to go back? But that's how cunning they were. They instilled it into these women that you are our escape. Finally, they were told, you know, what they were to do, which direction. Follow that and you'll come to a lake, you'll come to another lake, and so on and so forth. And they passed one lake when the men got back and the women let on. They didn't know that which direction. They all of a sudden woke up and they were no longer there. They lied, but they were the ones that helped the girls get away. But the men followed them. And the thing I cannot... like my mother mentioned in that story, was them gathering those rush reeds, you know, the little round rush reeds that you see in the sluice?
Yes, yes.
They gathered that and tied them to use for, like, a raft.
I see.
And I've always wondered if I could go down and gather up a bunch and see if it would keep me afloat, eh?
Probably if you had enough of them.
But they were supposed to have pulled out a whole bunch of those and tied them to get across a lake.
If you tied them in big bunches,
I imagine they would float, eh?
Yeah.
They should.
But just to, like the story tells, you know, and they were given 2 or 3 pairs of moccasins each. So if one wears out, they just slip on a new pair, and they had a bag of dried meats and fish and everything.
Mm.
And the girls made it. They must have got down towards somewhere along the lakes here, because the old people, when their daughters were taken away, they would have a tiny little bit of a fire. They'd move all around the lakes, and they would say, tell his wife, oh, they'll be back, the girls will make it, they'll be back. They had so much confidence that, you know, the girls would make it. So this one day, I guess the old man had a little tiny fire by the lake, and Sianetqua, well, she hadn't had that name yet, she noticed that little fire, and she told her younger sister, I'll bet you that's our mother and father.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this special kind of a loon call,
mm-hmm.
and she made that loon call, making believe there was a loon out on the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And the father heard it, and he told his wife, there they are, the girls are back. and he answered in the loon call. And the girls knew that was their parents, and they ran over the shore, and up there they were. And that second time they ran away, they were taken to, I imagine that's the one they called Shen Mausen now, is that, what is the name of it, that big resort way up, is it Amnesty Arm?
Mm-hmm.
That's the Indian name for that, Shen Mausen, is because it comes way around like this.
Right.
That's where the biggest tribe of the Shuswap people at the time were camped.
Oh, really?
So the grandparent, or the mother and father took their daughter back and told their uncles and aunts and grandparents, our girls came back again. So because of the brave way they always defeated the enemy and made that escape, they named the oldest one Sianetqua. Because no matter where she went, she, no matter what waters, she went over or went around or what, she always made it back.
That's
so that was a one instance of a naming ceremony for a girl.
That's really interesting.
But that was all based on the that self-awareness and self-discipline, and that was on just for survival.
Sure. That's good. If I could just ask you a couple of quick questions. When the girls were out on their ceremony, on their rite, did they come back into the tribe at all, or did they have to remain totally by themselves the entire time?
They never did want to come back, I guess. They were away all the time.
Yeah.
Until the day they figured they were
ready
to
come back
and join the tribe. Oh. They never, they wouldn't come back, they wouldn't come near the...
They
stayed away until such time they were ready to come back. And when they came back, that's when there was a celebration.
And that's when they came and they danced their dance and they told the story.
She was, like she would have all these garments, I guess, and moccasins or whatever she had. That was totally discarded and she was given
all new outfits,
baskets. She was given a lot of gifts from the elders.
Did she wear special, didn't she have special things done to her hair and wear special clothing when she went away so that everybody would know?
Yes, they
when she
had
went
to,
away? To,
yeah.
On those, yes, they...
I remember being told she'd wear a white robe with a red...
No, them stable. Days, I guess, they never had to... The identity for a girl that was out for this special purpose was always like, it could be branches or it could be cedar boughs or something was made into a hat like. That's what she wore. That was the idea. She hid her hair. The hair was all hidden away and was covered with boughs, cedar boughs or fir boughs. She would tie on the top, like all the big ends, and the finer she had over her hair all the time.
While she was on her quest, really?
She hid away her hair, her braids were all hidden away.
Did she make her own lodge, or was that made for her?
Well, the first time she was moved out of the tribe, her lodge was made by the elders. But once she...
You have been listening to the wisdom of Dr. Mary Thomas in an interview with Don Sawyer. The recording was made over 30 years ago. We apologize for the quality of some parts.